I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Mumtaz Ahmed. He's the executive director of IRD and professor of political science at the International Islamic University in Islamabad, and vice president these days as well, just for kicks, is that right? He's served as a member of Islam and Social Change Project at the University of Chicago and was on the very large project at the University of Chicago under the editorship of Martin Marty, one of my old teachers, on the Fundamentalism Project over a number of years. And he has been a senior consultant and a fellow of actually too many institutions to mention. Published a great deal of work, and I'm simply delighted that you're with us.
Thank you.
Today, you're going to speak about the Afghanistan endgame and the future of militancy in Southwest Asia.
Thank you very much, David. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here in a cold afternoon. There's quite a switch from yesterday's topic, from blasphemy to Afghanistan. I don't think there's any connection between the two topics. But in the meantime, let's see if I can utter a few blasphemous remarks about the end game in Afghanistan, if I may. As many of you know, Afghanistan is not new to foreign invasions, takeovers, regime change, and then at the end of the day, withdrawals. It all began, I'm not going to begin with the invasion of Alexander the Great, that's going too far in history, but let's begin with the 19th century when the British had some designs of Afghanistan, and they fought three major wars in the 19th century, and then in the 20th century, ultimately, they had to withdraw. In recent history, 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and then ultimately, in 1989, suffered a humiliating defeat and had to withdraw. After that, you had the small periods, some very brief period, when the Mujahideen took over Afghanistan from 1990 up to 1996 probably. Then in 1996, the Taliban came into power, and then in 2001, the Taliban were ousted by the U.S. invasion after the events of 9/11. And now we are looking forward to 2014, when the United States and the NATO forces are also planning to withdraw from Afghanistan. So Afghanistan has a long history of invasions and takeovers and regime change and the ultimate withdrawals. Hamid Karzai's government that was installed by the United States through the elections that were very conveniently rigged twice by the international community, including the NATO forces. Every time there was a promise for change and hope for peace and stability, and finally returning again and again to a situation of chaos and civil wars and bloodsheds. Yet another alien force that enters Afghanistan in the 1980s, and very few people now talk about that invasion, was the Islamist foreign forces, fighters from all over the world, to fight on the side of the Mujahideen, who were recruited by the Pakistani intelligence services, by the United States CIA, by the Saudis, and by other Muslim countries that sided themselves with the United States in order to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. These foreign Islamist militants and fighters who were assembled from all over the world, after the Soviets withdrew, they didn't go back to their countries, of course. They stayed in Afghanistan after the Soviet withdrawal. According to several conservative estimates, they numbered between 5,000 to 6,000 foreign troops. According to some sources, there may be probably 10,000 if you include the Uzbeks, the Pakistanis and Tajiks also that came from the neighboring countries. Osama bin Laden, of course, was one of them who came from Saudi Arabia to join his Muslim brothers in Afghanistan to fight against the Soviets. And as I said, after the Soviets withdrew in 1989, most of these Islamist fighters who had come to fight jihad against the atheist the Soviet forces, they remained in Afghanistan, and there were a couple of reasons. One is that while many of the Muslim countries, particularly in Egypt, in Morocco, in Tunisia, in Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, were eager to send them to Afghanistan to fight against the Soviets, they were not willing to take them back after the Soviet withdrawal. And the reason was that if you are a Saudi monarch, if you are a Saudi ruler or a Egyptian ruler, you don't want to receive back into your country hardened veterans of long war who know nothing except fighting and who have been trained in the use of sophisticated weapons and who can take up arms against your own government. So most of these people remained in Afghanistan after the Soviet withdrawal, and then they were the ones who established Al-Qaeda and some of the other militant and terrorist organizations that were held responsible by the United States for the tragedy of 9/11. So later on, they became the allies of the Taliban in Afghanistan. They still remain in Afghanistan and the northern part of the Pakistani territory, particularly in north and south Waziristan, which is the tribal area of Pakistan. Already we hear there is a possibility that United States, although it has decided and publicly declared that it will withdraw its forces, all its forces, at the end of 2014, according to the announcement of President Obama, which he repeated in his State of the Union address. But already there is a considerable talk in Washington that the United States may not withdraw its entire forces even after 2014. United States and Afghanistan government are negotiating a bilateral treaty under which the United States will keep some of its troops. According to some estimates, there may be 10,000 to 8,000 for what they are called for, training the Afghan security forces and coming to the aid of Afghan security forces if there is an imminent threat to Hamid Karzai's government or whoever succeeds Hamid Karzai after the April 2014 elections in Afghanistan. There is the jury in Washington seems to be still out on the question whether the United States should keep a sizable number of troops in Afghanistan after it withdraws in 2014. There are powerful lobbies in Washington, especially as represented by the intelligence community and by the Pentagon, that the United States must remain engaged in Afghanistan even after 2014, in the sense that the United States must keep its special operation forces and its air bases. You must have heard about the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. The United States seems to have spent close to $400 million in the construction and expansion of the airbase. And the work has not stopped yet. In fact, the speed at which the airbase is being expanded has increased considerably over the past few months. which all indicates that the United States has no intention in leaving Afghanistan lock, stock and barrel. I met a German ambassador, a former German ambassador in Afghanistan, in Berlin a few months ago, and he said that he has seen the airbase, and he has seen not only that airbase, he has seen four other bases in Afghanistan, and in Helmand province, in Kandahar province, and a couple of other places. And according to his estimate, the United States seemed to have spent about $700 million on constructing those air bases. And he was wondering, he said that if I had spent $700 million in putting together these bases, I'm not leaving. And it appears that I have no intention of leaving, because you don't make such a huge investment if you really want to leave that place. So it appeared that the United States will continue to have its special forces stationed there, and probably some combat troops also in four or five permanent bases, including the biggest one that I mentioned in Bagram Air Base, in order to use against possible regrouping of Al-Qaeda and Taliban and other inimical groups, and particularly in support of the Afghan government. The groundwork for this has already been done under the Strategic Alliance Agreement that is being negotiated between the Karzai government and the United States. Recently, I had the occasion of talking to some of the Afghan government officials who were attending a conference in Germany, and whenever I mentioned 2014, I saw some kind of a sense of irritation on their part at the mention of the year of the declared withdrawal of the U.S. troops. And the reason is probably for their irritation is a sense that if the United States withdraws all its troops, and the question that they face is whether the Afghan National Security Forces will be able to keep the Taliban at bay once the NATO forces are gone. The forces and the question that comes to their mind is that if 49 countries of the world, including all the NATO member states, were unable to stabilize Afghanistan for the past 13 years, how can the ragtag Afghan National Security Army, National Security Force, will be able to contain the Taliban or the fight against the remnants of Al-Qaeda and to maintain law and order in a society that is already dysfunctional, divided, ethnically divided, regionally divided. And despite the fact that the Afghan army and the security forces have been trained by the United States and other NATO countries, including the Canadian troops, so far, according to many observers, the Afghan army is only the figment of the imagination of international community. It simply does not exist. So far, during the past 4 years, Afghan army has never undertaken a single combat operation independently. Not a single combat operation independent. Every time the Afghan army was asked to go and fight against the Taliban, they had to be accompanied by the U.S. forces. And this is a fact that is very scary for many people. And surprisingly, General McChrystal, when he had put together a plan to establish an Afghan army, what they call the Afghan National Security Forces, and the idea was to put together an Afghan National Security Force numbering 400,000. Now, of course, they're talking about 350,000, and some of the people in Pentagon are talking about 200,000, 250,000. But imagine, even to keep an Afghan army, for example, you will not be able to recruit that much number of the Afghan troops. Nowhere. You can't do that. But even if you are able to put together an Afghan national security force numbering 200,000 to 250,000, the minimum cost per year is about $6 billion. The total budget of the Afghan government is $6 billion. Who's going to pay them? And they have no weapons, they have no tanks, they have no aircrafts, they have no helicopters. So who's going to equip them? Who's going to pay their salaries? Nobody knows. So, you see, it appears that during the past 13 years, the United States and the NATO forces have been busy so much in small skirmishes here and small skirmishes there. Small battle against the Taliban in this province and small battle against the Taliban that nobody had a time to have a long-term strategy, long-term policy that at the end of the day, when the NATO forces will withdraw, what will happen in Afghanistan. We all remember probably that at the eve of the Iraq invasion in 2003, when President Bush was discussing the possibility with his cabinet of invading Iraq, it is reported, I think it's in Bob Woodward's book, that General Colin Powell, who was the Secretary of State at that time, he went to see the President, President Bush in the White House, and he told the President, Mr. President, in Iraq, the party-bond rule applies, which means if you break it, you own it. And it appears that in Afghanistan, they forgot to apply this rule. They went into Afghanistan, that is the NATO and the United States went into Afghanistan, mess up the things, and now they want somebody else to clean it up. And not knowing what to do next. And this is one tragedy that the Afghan government will have to have. Now, as someone put it, the problem in Afghanistan is not, as many people have said, that the Taliban are strong. The problem is that the Afghan state is weak. When we were in graduate schools, Theda Scotchfell, a graduate of Harvard, who studied with Barrington Moore Jr., Mustafa will remember, having read her monumental book, The State and Social Evolution, she came to University of Chicago for a couple of years, and I was there at that time. And one of the most important insights that she discusses in her book, The State and Social Revolution, is that the revolutions take place not when the classes are strong, but when the state is weak. This is precisely the situation in Afghanistan. It's not that the Taliban are in a huge, exercising huge power in that country. It is not that they are the most highly cohesive and most highly equipped force in Afghanistan. The problem is that the state, the government of Hamid Karzai, is so weak. As most of us know, that his government's control does not extend more than a couple of miles after the capital city of Kabul. And the government is so inept, so dysfunctional, so inefficient, and so corrupt, absolutely corrupt, that it personally has no legitimacy in the eyes of the people. The entire cabinet, including the parliament, consists of the people who are former warlords, crooks, gangsters, drug smugglers, narco traffickers, weapon smugglers, and those who probably whose only source of income is either the money that they are making from drug trades or the suitcases full of dollars that they receive from the U.S. Embassy, period. President Bush invaded Afghanistan, if you remember, promising to build a nation which is democratic, which is pluralist, which is united, which is peaceful, and which is stable. Now, 13 years down the road, after more than 2,900 lives of American troops and more than $700 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money spent, you leave a country behind that is virtually you leave a government behind which has virtually no control over more than 70% of the territory of the country in Afghanistan, which is most corrupt and which is most directionless and totally dependent on foreign donors. 80% of the budget of the Afghan government comes from the foreign donations, mostly from the United States and NATO forces, NATO countries, some from Japan and some from Gulf countries. Even for the payment of salaries, the Karzai government is dependent on foreign donations. So the question that must be asked at the time of the withdrawal of the American troops is, what is going to happen to Afghanistan after 2014? And then, with that kind of a government in place, if we expect that this government will be able to maintain law and order and security after the withdrawal of the NATO troops, we are living in a fool's paradise. The U.S. defense planners envisage a structure of Afghan security forces, which, as I said earlier, close to about $250,000 to $300,000. And then the question again and again that is being raised in Afghanistan and in countries around neighboring Afghanistan is who is going to equip them, who is going to pay for them, and where is the money, where the money will come to equip and to sustain the army in Afghanistan. I recently was looking at some of the statements of President Obama about, because President Obama, when he campaigned during his election, he made a distinction between a good war and a bad war. Iraq war was a bad war. Afghanistan war was a good war. And he claimed that as a result of the policies, particularly pursued by his government, he said that we have pushed the Taliban out of their strongholds. I will not mention, when we went to, when the United States went to Afghanistan in 2001, if you remember, we had a long list of objectives that we wanted. We mean the United States. I'm from the United States. We wanted to achieve a number of objectives. Of course, the first objective was articulated by Laura Bush. She said that we are invading the country to open the girls' schools there. And if you remember, this probably was the first time in the entire history of humanity where a foreign country was invaded in order to open girls' schools there. That's another issue. Secondly, the other objective was, we are going to take out, eradicate, dismantle, disrupt, destroy Al-Qaeda. Thirdly, to dislodge the Taliban. Fourth, to make Afghanistan a model of moderate Muslim country, a stable country. Come Obama, all these objectives are forgotten because Obama realizes that we are not in the business of nation building. We have not been able to achieve all these objectives during the past 8-9 years, so modified the objectives. And the objective was only to make sure that Afghanistan does not in the future become a safe haven for anti-American militants, terrorists. That's the only objective Obama wanted to achieve, to push the Taliban out from their stronghold. Fine. They pushed the Taliban out of their stronghold. But who did they push into the government in Kabul? I was looking at the number of the at the names of the cabinet ministers of Hamid Karzai in his first government, in his second government, and his third government. Then you look at the names of the members of the parliament who were elected in the first parliament, in the second parliament. Nobody has probably told you before this. 80% of the members of his cabinet and the members of his parliament today are the former Mujahideen, former Taliban warlords and the drug dealers. So when President Obama says that we pushed out the Taliban from the stronghold, the question that must be asked is, who were pushed into this new political dispensations? The answer is the same gang, the Taliban, or the former Taliban. So, given this situation, one of the most important questions that must be raised is, what possible scenarios can we visualize in Afghanistan after the withdrawal of the U.S. forces in 2014? A friend of mine, Dr. Rasool Rais, who teaches at Lahore University of Management, recently published an article in which he constructed three scenarios, what he called, these are the three things that could happen in Afghanistan. One, and he's very optimistic, he's a good, keen observer of the Afghan situation. According to him, one scenario is the emergence of what he calls a functional state in Afghanistan. In other words, Afghanistan survives as a state, and there's a process of what he calls a double reconciliation. In other words, negotiations between the Taliban and the Kabul government, whoever succeeds, Hamid Karzai, and then the negotiations between the Taliban and the Northern Alliance. This is what called the double reconciliation. If this thing happens, if the newly elected government that succeeds Hamid Karzai after the April 2014 elections enters into some successful negotiations with the Taliban on the one hand, and then the Taliban are able to reconcile with the Northern Alliance, which consists of the Uzbeks and Tajiks and Hazaras, then there is a possibility that a functional state may come into being in Afghanistan. And of course, this will also be this could only be possible if the international community continues to remain engaged in the affairs of Afghanistan and it does not totally disengage itself. The second scenario, according to Dr. Rais, is the emergence of a nominal state. In other words, whereby the central authority, whoever holds the central authority, will be limited in Kabul, the city of Kabul. And then the splinter groups, the Taliban in the southern Afghanistan and the Northern Alliance in the northern Afghanistan, will have their own separate domains. And there will be a nominal state without any authority over the rest of the country that will remain confined only in the capital city of Kabul. And the third possible scenario, according to Rais, is that a civil war breaks out because the Pashtuns are not the Taliban who represent the Pashtun population. They are denied their fair share in the Afghan National Army and in the mainstream politics. And then again what happens, what really happened in the 1990s, which is a civil war between the Pashtuns and the Northern Alliance, and between one province and the other, one warlord against the other. And this seems to be probably, according to many people, more probable scenario is the third scenario. This, another very astute observer, Ann Jones, based in New York, and her scenario are more or less the same thing, but she calls the three C's: compromise, conflict, and collapse. By compromise, she means that the possibility of reaching some sort of almost, I would say, inconceivable scenario of some power sharing agreement with multiple insurgent militias. The Tajiks, the Uzbeks, the Hazaras, and the people from Herat to Ghazni to Badakhshan to Kandahar to Helmand to Patika province, and or somehow or the other through some magical wand, all these groups sit together and they say, okay, let's agree on some power sharing formula, and then what you call the great compromise in the U.S. Constitution making, that takes place. And this, again, can only happen if Washington, before leaving Afghanistan, enters into some kind of a negotiation with the Taliban. Because the major party, the major contending party in the power struggle remains the Taliban. If the Taliban are not engaged in some kind of a negotiations, no power sharing formula will succeed in Afghanistan in the near future. Of course, President Hamid Karzai recently has shown a great deal of willingness as well as eagerness to seek those leaders among the Taliban movement who can talk to him. And if you remember, the effort that was made to establish an office of the Taliban in Qatar, in Doha, was part of that deal where the United States wanted to enter into some kind of a negotiations with the Taliban. Ultimately, the negotiations broke down on some trivial issue. But this compromise is one possibility which we can look forward to. The second scenario is open conflict. And that would mean another dreaded round of civil war, like the one in the 1990s after the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan, and which basically destroyed the Afghan capital, Kabul, and devastated part of the country. And the third scenario is a total collapse of the Afghan state. And this is, which is more apocalyptic kind of scenario. It is seldom brought out, brought up by the Afghan themselves, but it is implied in the exodus that is already underway from Afghanistan. I have read reports in the New York Times and some of the Pakistani newspapers, and will say that close to 35,000 Afghans are leaving their country every day. Most of them middle class, most of them business people, most of them educated. And overwhelming majority of them are those who had established very successful businesses during the occupation by the U.S. forces, NATO forces during the past 10 years, who had made millions and millions of dollars as a result of the U.S. occupation, doing some contractual work for the U.S. Forces there. They have made millions of dollars, and now where they are going? They are going to Dubai to save their money, because they are visualizing a future, a dreadful future of civil war, and they want to save themselves and their families, and they're leaving the country. So this is one good indicator to see how the Afghan people see their own future. With respect to Afghanistan, my feeling is that the critical thing is the political transition in Afghanistan. If there are elections in April 2014, and if the elections are relatively fair, and if the elections are not blatantly rigged by Hamid Karzai, then of course there is a possibility that some political stability may emerge after the elections, because then the government that will come into power as a result of that free and fair election will have more legitimacy to represent the people of Afghanistan, to negotiate with its neighbors, to negotiate with the United States a more acceptable deal, a future strategic relationship with the United States and NATO countries, and will have a more legitimacy to enter into negotiations with the Taliban. So ultimately, much depends on the results and on the modality of the 2014 April elections. And I think that the West does not have the... let me go back and say, majority of Afghans who believe that they can deal with the international community and they can seek considerable foreign aid from the countries, and they can also enter into some kind of negotiations with the Taliban, they are the ones who will be much more relevant in the new political dispensations. There are two views here. One view is the fear that everyone in the region, whether you are talking about Pakistan or United States, the Central Asian states bordering with Afghanistan, particularly Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and other stands, they will walk away, leaving Afghanistan to settle their own scores. And then their other view is that the West, particularly the United States, will totally disengage itself. It will have no money to spare for the poor Afghan, and it will have no will to continue to engage itself in the Afghan situation. Pashtuns are the critical factor in the future of Afghanistan. As we know that the Pashtuns are mostly in the southern part of the country, bordering the northern areas of Pakistan, they constitute the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. Most observers agree that despite the fact that the Pashtuns are the largest ethnic groups, they will not be able to rule and capture the country on their own. They will not be able to establish their hegemonic control as they did to a certain extent in the 1990s until and unless they reach some kind of settlement with the Tajiks and the Hazara and the Uzbeks and the other groups in the country. Finally, there's another important thing that one has to remember is that on the one hand, it will not be possible for the Taliban to reconquer the country, the entire country, and to establish their hegemony. On the other hand, there is no other power in Afghanistan that will be able to establish its hegemony there. So there will be a stalemate for all practical purposes. Having said that, there have been very clear indications that the Taliban of today are not the Taliban of the 1990s. They have undergone a considerable transformation over the years as a result of their experience in the government as well as their experience when they were out of the government. Taliban seem to have been undergoing some changes in terms of their now acceptance of the girls' education, which at that time, as you remember, they closed down most of the girls' schools. But now, if you look at some of their policy statements, now they are saying that the reason why they closed down all the girls' schools in the 1990s was because there was a precarious law and order situation, and they did not want to put the lives of the girls in jeopardy. That's why they forbid them to attend the schools. But now they have accepted that the girls have a right to education. Their interaction with the media has considerably changed. Their relationship with Al-Qaeda has changed, and now there are clear policy statements by Mullah Omar, who is the leader of the Afghan Taliban, and some of the senior leaders of the Taliban that if they come to power again in Afghanistan, they will not allow any internationally linked terrorist organization to operate from their country. And this is the firm commitment they are willing to give. And I think one of the reasons why President Obama's government started negotiations or started to talk about talks in Qatar was that they received a firm assurance from the Taliban leadership that they will cut off all their links with Al-Qaeda and will not allow them to operate from their territory. The United States policymakers, let's talk about the what are the possible impact of the withdrawal on the neighboring countries, particularly Pakistan, and what we consider the possibility of the emergence of more militant movements in that part of the world. It's very interesting to observe that the United States policymakers worry that the NATO pullout would increase Pakistan's influence in Afghanistan. On the other hand, the U.S. government also expects Pakistan to play a very important role in the future of Afghanistan in order to make sure that Afghanistan does not degenerate into same situation in which it was in the late 1980s and early 1990s. When Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, she used to say that there was no alternative for the United States to protect its national interests except sustaining the difficult relationship with Pakistan. And Pakistan remains the most important strategic asset as well as the liability for the United States. So it's both, it cuts both ways for them. And it is interesting to note that despite the enormous sympathy and support that the Pakistani intelligence establishment has been giving to the Taliban over the past several years, Pakistan also has used its influence to moderate the Taliban and had made a distinction always between the good Taliban and the bad Taliban. The Pakistani establishment's formulation reads like this, that the good Taliban are those who are fighting only against the foreign occupation, which is against the United States. The bad Taliban are those who are linked with Al-Qaeda and with the Pakistani Taliban. Because the Pakistani Taliban are fighting against the Pakistani military establishment and the Pakistani citizens. And they are involved in terrorist activities in Pakistan. So the sympathies of the Pakistani intelligence community, ISI, are with the Taliban with the Afghan Taliban, who are only fighting against the United States. Clear and simple. But the Pakistani intelligence community has not supported those factions of the Taliban that are still linked with Al-Qaeda. This is the distinction that they have already maintained. The United States, of course, have always insisted that the Pakistanis do not make any distinction between good Taliban and bad Taliban and should initiate a major combat operation against all kinds of Taliban. And the Pakistanis have so far refused to do that. The Pakistanis are also afraid about the spillover effect of the U.S. withdrawal after 2014. What are the reasons? If there is a civil war in Afghanistan, the first country that will suffer the consequences will be Pakistan. It's a neighboring country. When the Soviet invaded Afghanistan, Pakistan ended up hosting 5 million Afghan refugees. So if again there is a civil war, there will be again between 2 to 3 million refugees that Pakistan will end up hosting. And if you look at the meager resources, financial resources of the Pakistani state, it will be enormous burden for the Pakistanis to bear in terms of its social services, in terms of health facilities, education facilities. And with the onslaught and with the advent of the refugees come drugs, weapons, and all kinds of problems of law and order and security and smuggling. And then all kinds of militant activities and forces that come. Much of the militancy in Pakistan today, if you look at the, if you follow the Pakistani news, you might have noticed that hardly a day passes when there is no any terrorist activity. And it's no longer confined in the northern areas of Pakistan. Bomb blasts take place in Karachi, in Lahore, in Rawalpindi, in Islamabad. And but in most cases, it is in the northern areas. And increasingly, the people who are being targeted are the Pakistani security forces. During the past week, there have been 3 major incidents in which 20 Pakistani security forces have been killed. In 3 cases, their throats have been slashed, and they show the video in which the Taliban are kicking the slashed heads of the Pakistani soldiers, troops, like a football, kicking them like a football. And these are the kind of things that the Pakistani army and the Pakistani security forces are facing these days. So, whatever militancy is taking place in Pakistan, it is a result of the situation in Afghanistan. So, if Afghanistan destabilizes further, Pakistan will suffer enormous consequences. And so, if there is one country in the region, and that this is something that very few people in, particularly not in, I'm not talking about in Canada, in the United States, very few people who realize this. Everyone in Washington is critical of Pakistan, that the Pakistani ISI is playing a double game and all these things. But one thing they don't know or they don't want to know is that if there is one country on the face of the earth that is most interested in establishing peace and order and stability in Afghanistan, it should be Pakistan. Because it has suffered a lot, and it will suffer probably much more if Afghanistan remains destabilized. Because then every warring faction in Afghanistan will enter into Pakistan, particularly in the tribal areas, what we call the non-settled area, in which the Pakistani government has no control. Even now, Pakistan uses sometimes very coercive methods to keep them in line, which is the militants in Afghanistan. And the negative fallout of the withdrawal of the NATO forces from Pakistan will be disastrous. Pakistan would continue to be burdened by the presence of more than 3 million refugees in its territory, and it will continue to suffer the consequences of the civil war if there is no stability in that country. The other important thing is that the Pakistani Taliban, who are fighting inside Pakistan against the Pakistani security forces, they are launching attack in Pakistan in solidarity with the Afghan Taliban. And what is their argument? They are saying that they are fighting against the Pakistani government because the Pakistani government is supporting the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Because the Pakistani government is providing the supply line to the NATO forces. The Pakistani government is providing the air bases to the NATO forces. The Pakistani government has been providing intelligence facilities to the U.S. forces. Therefore, according to them, the Pakistani government is a legitimate target for them. Now, what are the how are the regional powers involved, or how the regional powers will be involved in the post-withdrawal scenario? The interesting thing here to note is that, quite contrary to the public statements demanding the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan, every regional state in the neighborhood wants the Americans to stay. The Pakistanis want the Americans to stay, although they will never say it publicly. The Iranians probably want the Americans to stay, but not have their bases there. The Russians want them to stay. The Central Asians want them to stay. Why? Because they are afraid of the consequences of the withdrawal. Because none of the regional power is ready and prepared to face the consequences of the withdrawal. And their fear is about the continuation of the conflict and its escalation of the civil war will not remain confined within the boundaries of Afghanistan. It will have a spillover effect in Iran, spillover effect in Pakistan, spillover effect in Tajikistan, in Turkmenistan, in Uzbekistan, and then, of course, in China, where the Muslim separatists are fighting for autonomy and separation in Xinjiang province. And many of the Chinese separatists, Muslim separatists, have been trained in Afghanistan by the Taliban. The Indians are scared that if the Americans leave and Afghanistan becomes destabilized, or if Afghanistan comes under the control of the Taliban again, then the Taliban will support the Islamic militants who are fighting against India in Kashmir. And some of the Muslim dissident and Muslim jihadist forces in India will go to Afghanistan for training, because Afghanistan will become again a safe haven for international terrorist groups. The Russians are afraid because, you know, many of the Chechens are now fighting along with the Taliban. And many of the Chechens who fight against the Russians are trained in Afghanistan camps. So which regional power is there that would like the Americans to leave? None. But no one says it, because then you say, oh, you are supporting the foreign occupation. The United States, probably it would be one of the best things that was proposed to President Obama, which he didn't take up. One of his very serious mistakes in the early beginning was to have a regional conference of all the interested parties. Let's hold an international conference. Bring the Iranians, the Chinese, the Russians, the Indians, the Pakistanis, the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, and all these things and sit together. Look, it's a common interest. Sit together and forget about the raw memories of your own strategic rivalries in the past and come up with some solution. Unfortunately, I think probably the White House was quite amenable to the idea, but as we know that the Pentagon, people in the Pentagon, they don't want to share power with anybody. Therefore, the Pentagon rejected the idea and no such conference could take place. this is precisely the reason behind behind the scene maneuvers by some of the regional powers to convene independent of the United States their own mini conference and to put together to some kind of consensus on the future of Afghanistan. The Indians, for example, are very much concerned about it. First of all, India has already invested about $6 billion in development aid, as well as in some mineral development, in the training of the Afghan troops. The Indians are really afraid about the consequences of a civil war in Afghanistan, and they take over by the Taliban. The Pakistanis are afraid that if the Taliban are sidelined, or if the Taliban in Afghanistan are not in a position of power, then Afghanistan will become a staging ground for the Indians against Pakistan. Already the Pakistanis are accusing India that they are using the Afghan territory to launch, to promote separatist movement in Balochistan. So these are some of the very, very kind of intricate things that must be taken into consideration. As far as China is concerned, being a regional power, it is pursuing its pragmatic interest in that region. China has an eye over almost $1 trillion worth of the mineral resources of Afghanistan, particularly its gas resources. It has already probably invested more than $10 billion. And remember, the Chinese investment in Afghanistan took place during the American presence there. So in other words, there is an understanding between the Chinese and the Americans on that count. And China probably would remain much more engaged in the affairs of Afghanistan than the United States. Beijing seems to share the American view of transition, and it is trying to cement its relationship by showing a very keen interest in the reconstruction projects of Afghanistan and providing soft security assistance to the government in Afghanistan. In case of Iran, Iran probably is as much worried about the reemergence of Taliban as the United States is. Remember that the Taliban are very fierce Deobandi Sunni fanatics. And if those of you who have read about the history of when the Taliban were in power, in Mazar-e-Sharif, the Shia, how many Shias were killed? Probably close to thousands were. Shias were massacred by the Taliban. And it was during the Taliban regime that Iranian diplomats were killed when they were visiting Afghanistan. So the Iranians would be the last one to see the re-emergence of Taliban in Afghanistan. Here, the interests of the United States and Iran coincide. But then the Iranians are also afraid of the possibility that the Americans should not have any permanent bases there. Because any permanent bases of America in Afghanistan can be used against Iran in the future. And any permanent Air Force base is a very scary prospect for the Iranians, because it can be used as a listening post against its nuclear assets there. So it's not a very simple thing. It's a very complicated. On the one hand, there is areas of cooperation. On the other, there are some fear. Iranians definitely would like to improve their relationship with all the regional powers. And my feeling is that in the scenario that seems to be developing, Iran will try to work very closely with India, with Russia, with Central Asian states. On the other hand, the Pakistanis, and with the Northern Alliance. On the other hand, the Pakistanis would like to work closely with the Taliban and with the Saudis. And if this happens, that will be probably a most destabilizing alliance that will take place. But this is one thing that seems to be emerging. Finally, let me make some concluding observations, and then I will leave some time. My main argument is that regardless whether a security agreement is signed between Afghanistan and United States, and assuming that Afghanistan does not become again a haven of terrorism that targets the United States, the U.S. interests in Afghanistan will diminish down the road. That's my argument number one. If Afghanistan does not become a safe haven for international terrorism that targets the United States, all other terrorists are fine. If those terrorists are targeting Pakistan and Iran, the United States doesn't bother. U.S. interest will definitely diminish down the road. And not only the U.S. interest will diminish, so too will be U.S. resources that will be invested in that country, whether the resources are military, political, economic, developmental, or diplomatic. In addition to that, the neighboring powers such as India and Iran and Pakistan, who have an immediate stake in a secure and stable Afghanistan, will become more important players. That's my argument number two. Along with these countries, Russia, China, Central Asia, Saudi Arabia will also become very important players in Afghanistan. And with so many foreign actors playing their strategic games inside Afghanistan, the dream of Afghanistan for a peaceful and prosperous heart of Asia will remain unrealized for quite some time to come. Now, the argument that continued investment in Afghanistan is essential, which sometimes you listen to the those think tankers in Afghanistan that are close to the Pentagon, that Afghanistan will remain a very important strategic spot for the United States, and therefore we should continue to remain engaged in Afghanistan, because we have already made a great deal of investment, political, social, developmental, and we have made a lot of sacrifices. I think this argument will lose potency. One reason is that the Americans want more funds for their home, obviously. Secondly, the continued budget deficits in the United States will not make it possible for the American public opinion to spare billions and billions of dollars, continue to be poured in a country that for overwhelming majority of the Americans has no significance for them. Thirdly, I think United States will remain in that particular region more engaged with Pakistan and with India. Why? Pakistan as a source of concern and India as a source of opportunity. United States in the region, if there is any country that troubles United States, it is Pakistan. Pakistan is five times, how many? Many times larger than. Afghanistan's total population is how much? 20 million? Pakistan is 180 million. Probably the fifth largest country in the world. And much more important, it's a nuclear country. Any instability, any civil war, any chaos, any breakdown and collapse of the state in Pakistan will have catastrophic significance and consequences for the entire region. So it is Pakistan which will remain a source of worry and concern. And it will be India which will remain a source of opportunity for. And the third reason is, as President Obama recently said, he is looking for what he calls the rebalancing of U.S. policy towards Asia-Pacific. If there is any region in the world that will constitute priority number one for U.S. planners, strategic planners and policymakers, it will be Asia-Pacific, not the Middle East, not West Asia, not Europe, and absolutely not Africa and Latin America. Asia-Pacific is the one where 95% of the attention of the U.S. policymakers will be devoted in the future. In the long term, an unstable Pakistan is far more threatening to the United States' interest. Because, as I said, Pakistan has a population of more than five times that of, 10 times more that of Afghanistan. It possesses nuclear weapons, and it is home to multiple insurgencies in Balochistan, in North Waziristan, and some of these insurgencies are led by extremists with far more ambitious objectives than the insurgents in Afghanistan. Far more ambitious objectives. And unfortunately, having links with the militants in the Middle East, in North Africa, and even in Southeast Asia. And let me scare you a little bit more. It is Pakistan whose diaspora exists in Europe and in America. And it are the Pakistani young men who are being caught in London, right? In Manchester and Bradford, and in New York, and in San Francisco, on charges of terrorism, suspicion of terrorism. So who cares for Afghanistan? And who cares for it? It's the Pakistan that will become the centerpiece for the attention of the United States in the region. Because of all these things. And it has a bigger, as I said, stakes because of its nuclear capability. And also because of its perennial tensions with India that can make the situation explosive any time. There have been four instances during the past 20 years when there was a real threat of the breakout of a nuclear war between the two countries. And then it's Pakistan where political instability is more usual kind of thing, common. And then stark economic inequality that can trigger a lot of things in terms of social. These are all very ugly combinations. So my final conclusion is that there would be far more wider consequences of an unstable Afghanistan, not just for the Afghan themselves, but for their neighbors, and in particular, for Pakistan, and especially the possibility of strengthening the militant forces, not only in Pakistan, but also in neighboring India. Why? If you look at the election campaign in India going on right now, there are two, the rival forces that challenges the Congress Party is the BJP. And BJP is campaigning essentially on anti-Muslim platform. And the more anti-Muslim rhetoric comes out of the platform of BJP, the more Muslim Islamic militancy is strengthened in India. And then those Muslim militants will seek support from Pakistani militants and the Afghan militants. On a positive note, however, to end, there's a remarkable confluence of interest among the permanent five members of the United Nations Security Council with regard to Afghanistan, in stark contrast with other regions of the world. On the Middle East and on many other areas of the world, the five permanent members of the Security Council will never agree. Surprisingly, on the issue of Afghanistan, there is an unusual confluence of interest among the permanent members of the United Nations. Russia and China, United States, France, Britain, all of them, they want Afghanistan to remain stable. And I think the stability of Afghanistan, essentially because of the fact that preventing it becoming a kind of incubator for terrorism and drug production and other illicit activities, is the most important thing that everyone wants. But this shared vision to contain terrorism and to improve security and exploit opportunities for trade and economic cooperation and all these things is compromised by a number of factors, which I indicated earlier, which is that there are raw memories of the regional actors, India and Pakistan, Iran and the United States, China and Russia. And if these raw memories can be forgotten and can be kind of something can be done about it, then there is a possibility that some agreement can be reached. But the most important thing is the perennial standoff between India and Pakistan. That will loom large. And this is very evident from the Pakistan's support for the Taliban and the India's perception that Taliban are and will constitute a major threat to its security. If we remember that most of the militant groups that are fighting against India in Kashmir, Jaish-e-Mohammed, Lashkar-e-Taiba, Harkatul Ansar, Harkatul Mujahideen, Harkatul Ansar, all the terrorist militant organizations that have fought in the Indian Kashmir against the Indian forces are based in Pakistan and were trained in Afghanistan. That makes the situation very scary. So this, with this optimistic and pessimistic scenario combined, I conclude my few observations about Afghanistan. I'm sorry, I'm not an expert on international relations. I just wanted to make a brief presentation on the PowerPoint. That's why I picked up these small pieces. But then I realized I don't know how to operate PowerPoint. Thank you very much. By the way, this morning, David recommended a bookstore, the Edmonton bookstore. I went there, I picked up a book. It's called, what we talk about when we talk about war. It's a book by Noah Rishla, and this book is about the Canadian involvement in the Afghanistan war. And I just sort of was looking through this book after I bought this morning, and it's anyone who is interested in the involvement of Canada in Afghanistan must read this book. Basically, its argument is, if I could understand, Canada is not an imperialist power. It has never any, and never will have any imperialist ambitions. Since World War II, Canada has sent its army abroad only for peacekeeping purposes. This is the first time that the Canadians sent their troops to fight. Not to open up the girls' schools, as Laura Bush would have done it, but only to please Washington. No other reason. The Canadian public opinion and the Canadian government was not convinced of the moral legitimacy of the war. They only wanted to please their neighbor. And they were looking for long-term relationship with the trade and economic relationship with the United States. That's why they tagged along. But the consequences for Canada, according to this author, are catastrophic, moral consequences. And for the future of the Canadian armed forces. Some of the things that the Canadian troops, according to him, what they did in Afghanistan, no Canadian would have ever imagined. One of the brigadier general who was disgracefully dismissed from the service, having illicit sex relationship with the subordinate. By the way, he was arrested yesterday in Kabul because 125 rifles were found in his possession and all this. Yeah. After he was dismissed from the Canadian Armed Forces, he joined some private security company.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Yeah. But some of the things he's documenting here said that this would mean that in future Canadians will have to think several times before sending. Anyway.
Do you see in the American think tanks and what have you, do you see this shift towards a concern for Afghanistan? Are they developing their capacity to understand and to strike relationships to, or is there remaining this unbelievable ignorance?
It's both. Unbelievable ignorance is one factor. Arrogance is another. And the third is the persistence are insistent to continue to pursue wrong policies is another. America has a long tradition of doing that, beginning with the Vietnam War. Once you make a wrong decision, you don't want to correct it for quite a considerable number of period of time. Keep doing that. You keep adding, search, add more troops. And then suddenly you realize it never works, then you wash your hands off, and then you leave. Okay. And then the next mission. There were 2 points, for example, when President Obama was elected, and he said, I want to end this war. The general said, but before you end this war, let us send more troops. which basically was the same strategy that was practiced in Vietnam. When General Westmoreland, when President Johnson was saying, bring troops home, let's end the war, and Westmoreland said, send me 50,000 more troops and then I'll end the war. So he sent 50,000 troops and then he said 20,000 more, then 20,000 more. By the end of the term, 100,000 troops were added to Vietnam War. This again happened. That send us 30,000 more troops. President Obama was not convinced of the surge. He was forced to accept the dictate from the Pentagon. And he said, okay, I'll send 30,000 more troops, but then you have to give me some results. The military didn't show absolutely no positive results at the end of the search. What did they show? He said, in Helmand province, we have established complete peace. Okay? And then, within 2 or 3 months, they withdrew the troops and the Taliban were again in control. And when the hearing started in the Senate, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and their commander in Afghanistan, what was his alibi? He said, we were getting successful, the Pakistanis were the one to be blamed. The Pakistanis are cooperating with us. The Haqqani group. Are you name any kind of scapegoat? President Obama, I think his mind was on the kind of right. He made the right choices at the, but then he was totally overpowered by the overwhelmed by the Pentagon. Just four days ago, there was a story in the New York Times. And look at the absurdity. I mean, this gives you the mindset in at the Pentagon. The fundamental argument, and this was a front page story in the New York Times, against total withdrawal. And the story was based on sources that the reporter quoted from the Pentagon, said there is a strong opinion emerging from the U.S. Defense Forces against total withdrawal at the end of 2004. And what is the reason that they were giving not to withdraw the entire forces? He said, if we do not leave at least 10,000 troops and at least 4 or 5 major air bases in Afghanistan, how we will be able to continue the drone war? See the argument? How will we will be able to send drones to kill people in northern Waziristan? What is the subtext of this argument? The subtext is in other words, our fundamental objective is not to end the war and to establish peace and to fight the terrorism. Our fundamental objective is to continue the drone attacks.
But surely to goodness, in the United States, among the
look at the thinking.
Elite, this is not the only way in which they think. I mean, is it that bad?
I think it is that bad.
Don't they talk to you?
Look at the... I just started reading. I only finished about 57, 58 pages of former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates' book, Duty. And this is the man who has served 7 prisons.
Yeah.
And this is the man who supported the Afghan war, supported the Iraq war, and has been in in and out of the Defense Department, has been the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, has been the chairman of the National Intelligence Council, has been in the National Security Council of 2-3 presidents, and the ultimate is, whatever I could see, is that we lost the war in Iraq and Afghanistan because the Congress is stupid. And the people are stupid.
Well, you mentioned Baluchistan a couple of times. My understanding of some of the little bit of reading I've done is that they want to separate from Pakistan. And I thought that was their only, fight, that they just want to separate from Pakistan.
The Baluchistan situation is quite complex. First of all, I do not think that the overwhelming majority of the people in Baluchistan want to separate from the country. There are a few things that we have to know about Baluchistan. Baluchistan, in terms of territory, is the largest province of Pakistan. In terms of population, it is the smallest population of Pakistan. It's not very well populated. Probably it constitutes about 5% of the total population of the country. Thirdly, it's strategically very important. It borders Afghanistan and Iran. And then it has very strategic coastal area near the Gulf states. Fourthly, it is not ethnically homogeneous province. It is known as Balochistan. But the majority of the people who live in Baluchistan are Pashtuns. It's a very kind of anomalous situation. It is a territory, it's a region of Baloch. But Pashtuns probably outnumber, not overwhelmingly, but probably there will be 51% will be non-Baloch. Pashtun, but non-Baloch are more than 50%. There are Barohis, there are Pashtuns, there are Hazaras, Shias, there are Punjabi settlers, there are Kashmiri settlers there, who have been living there for about 100 years. Baloch essentially are in the near the Kalat, Mikran, coastal area, the Gavadar tribe. So far, these are the facts. The other fact is that Baluchistan is the poorest province of the country. Has been during the British period and after the establishment of Pakistan. The central government always neglected Baluchistan in terms of the disbursement of resources. So there's a great deal of discontentment on the part of the particularly Baloch, young, educated Baloch. Baluchistan is also very rich in minerals that have not yet been exploited fully. But even now, Baluchistan produces the largest quantity of gas, natural gas, sui gas, for example, from the Bugti area. The funny thing is that Baluchistan provides natural gas to the entire country. But the Baloch themselves do not get the benefit of that gas. The royalty is not shared equitably with the people of Baluchistan. Finally, Baluchistan is a tribal society. The Baloch tribes and the tribal chiefs, they dominate different, the Bhakti tribe, the Mari tribe, the Raisani tribe, and this tribe. And these tribal chiefs are the, like local dictators, warlords, who treat their people as their bonded labor and slaves. Any attempt on the part of the federal government and federal bureaucracy to contact and reach directly to the people in Balochistan is opposed by the tribal chiefs. The chief of the tribe wants the government to deal with him and not with the people. That is the source of the trouble. Any modernizing government at the federal level, any modernizing bureaucracy that wants to reach at the level of the people, wants to establish schools, health facilities, spread education, will be opposed and resented by the tribal chiefs. Now the tribal chief cannot stand up and fight against the federal government in the name of his own power. He will stand up and he will fight against the federal government in the name of the Baloch nation's national rights and ethnic rights. This is the old game that is being played in all tribal societies. And not only tribal societies, even in modern societies. You go to the city of Chicago, where you have what's called these machine politics. The in an Irish neighborhood, Italian neighborhood, they would never allow the common people, the constituents, to talk to the government. They said, I can deliver the votes, you talk to me. It's a machine politics kind of thing.
The other thing was the Hazara in Afghanistan. They're, of course, majority Shias.
Yeah. All Hazaras in Afghanistan are Shias. The Hazaras in Balochistan, mostly they live in Quetta city. Outside Quetta city, there's a very small number of Hazaras. In Quetta, mostly they are businessmen. Not very prosperous. In Pakistani Hazaras,
but I'm talking about the
Afghani
Hazaras. What happens to them in the 3C scenarios, or, you know, if the Pashtun take over, the Hazaras situation?
It's a very...
It improved in the last 10 years.
Yeah. It's a very precarious situation. And as I was saying earlier, the domestic political dispensation within Afghanistan will only take place within the larger bargaining among the regional powers. Okay. If the Taliban, Pakistan, and Iran can come up with some kind of a compromise formula, then there's a possibility of the involvement of the Hazaras in the power structure. If the Taliban continue to insist on their fundamentalist Wahhabi Deobandi ideology, considering Shias as enemies of Islam and are outside the fold of Islam, some heretic sect, then of course there is not going to be any reconciliation. On the other hand, if the Taliban realize that they cannot rule single-handedly, then ultimately they will have to reach some kind of an understanding with the Hazaras. And not only with the Hazaras, but even with their other Sunni brothers like Tajiks and Uzbeks, who are Sunnis. But even the Taliban didn't sit with them. They they killed as many Uzbeks and Tajiks as they killed the Hazaras. So ultimately, as I was saying, they have to make some compromise. If the Taliban have come to the conclusion that we are not interested in establishing our government in the entire country, and we will be satisfied with having a government only in the southern part of the country, then it's fine. They can forget about the Tajiks and Uzbeks and Hazaras. And they can have their own government in about 3-4 provinces, Pashtun provinces, that's fine. But that would be the end of Afghanistan as a united country. Afghanistan then will be divided. Northern Afghanistan, Central Afghanistan, Southern Afghanistan, period.
Please. I noticed when you were talking that when you talk about Pakistan, you seem to talk about that as a homogenous voice. But my understanding is that there's actually quite a bit of disagreements.
I agree.
Particularly with the civilian government and the military government, and whose decisions are actually being represented by Pakistan.
Yeah, you see. When I was talking about Pakistan, essentially, I was talking about the Pakistani security establishment. That, and there is what you can call some kind of unified entity or homogeneous kind of entity, which Pakistan is secured. If I was talking about the Pakistan socio-economic kind of situation, then of course you can have a differentiated view of rural Pakistan, urban Pakistan, middle class Pakistan, upper class Pakistan, Punjabis and Balochis and Sindhis. But when you are talking about Pakistan foreign policy, then basically you are talking about the Pakistani establishment, and that establishment is quite unified. Establishment is the Pakistani military, Pakistani bureaucracy, Pakistani intelligence people. That's establishment. That's what we do. And the civilian, and some civilian leaders occasionally.
So I'm just some clarity. Because, for example, the militant attacks in Pakistan have, until very recently, been targeted at civilians, really. I mean, last the minute I get affected, will my interests change? Or maybe this question is irrelevant.
You see, if you look at the history of the terrorist attacks in Pakistan, they only started after the Soviet invasion. After the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. Before 2001, there was no terrorism in Pakistan. I mean, there was sectarian violence, but that's a different thing. There was no terrorism, suicide bombing, not a single suicide bomb in Pakistan. It all started after this, all these things. And when did it start? It started basically in the northern part of Pakistan, North Waziristan, South Waziristan, when the Americans pushed the Taliban, and most of the Afghan Taliban took refuge in Pakistan because they crossed the border, and many of the Arab, quote-unquote, Arab Afghans also entered the Pakistani territory after the American invasion. And then the Americans insisted that the Pakistanis should now take care of these Arab Afghans and the Afghans who have now entered in the Pakistani territory. The Pakistani military started taking action against them. First, of course, was the agreement. General Musharraf, who was the president in Pakistan, he was a little reluctant in obliging the Americans on this demand, because he said that the area what's called the tribal area, FATA, federally administered tribal area. Pakistani military traditionally had never any military control. The understanding between the tribal area and the Pakistani government was that we will not, Pakistan will never allow its military to enter that area. This has been a convention, a tradition since the British period. So Musharraf has reluctant not to send his military there. They signed an agreement with the tribal chiefs, the Pakistani military, and the agreement said that these people will not initiate any attacks against the American troops crossing the borders. Obviously, they did not keep that promise, and then the Pakistani military took the action. That was the beginning of militancy and terrorism against the Pakistani security forces. Soon it spread to the civilians. As you remember that they would throw a bomb here in the marketplace and in the bus stations and the train stations and everywhere. So far, according to one estimate, the 46,000 Pakistanis have died in these terrorist activities compared to 3,000 people who died in the World Trade Center. More than probably 10,000 Pakistani soldiers have died, including generals, according to one study that was done by American Council for Foreign Relations about 3 years ago, that the highest ratio of the people who were killed among the Pakistani troops is that of the officers, people of the rank of the colonel, captain, brigadier, generals. So Pakistan has sacrificed a lot in that. And the reason these people started fighting against Pakistan, not Pakistani, only Pakistani military and police and security forces, but general, was that the Pakistani government has extended its support to the United States. So that's why the Pakistanis were targeted. That explains the militancy. Now the question that the Pakistanis are raising is, will militancy stop after the U.S. withdraws from Afghanistan? And there are some people who say that these militants in Pakistan will come up with some new reason to continue to fight. And already, for example, if you look at the Mullah Fazlullah, the new leader of the Pakistani Taliban, previously they were saying, we are fighting against the Pakistani government because the Pakistanis are supporting the Americans. Now they are saying, we are fighting the Pakistani government because the Pakistani government is not introducing Sharia laws. See, it's a game change. So American withdrawal from Afghanistan probably is not going to solve the Pakistani problem, the indigenous terrorism problem, unfortunately. Yes, you have the...
Yes. I was wondering whether, if one were living in Afghanistan and one supported traditional Canadian values, which are defined as peace, order, and good government, and you were in one or another place or community, could you find anyone that you wish to support?
That's a wonderful conclusion of this evening discussion. I think you're absolutely right. From the very beginning, I would say, military action was not a solution from the very beginning. First of all, as many people said, that the Taliban and the Afghanistan, they didn't attack the United States on 9/11.
invading Afghanistan was not the logical and rational response by the United States. Al-Qaeda could have been taken out with the surgical operation without invading the entire country. They said that it could have taken about a couple of weeks for them to take out all the Al-Qaeda with all the sophisticated aerial and drones and other technology that was available. Sending troops, destroying the entire country. And they said, at that time, said that Rumsfeld said that we will, before the attack, said that we'll throw the country into the Stone Age. Yeah. And somebody said, we are already in the Stone Age. Yeah, the Afghans are already in the Stone Age. Yeah. Anyway, once they had done it, but and even if they had taken the military action, removed the and how many days did it take for the U.S. to remove the Taliban? 1 week. The Taliban did not put up a fight in a single battlefield. Go back and read the stories in the New York Times. From the day. They did not put up a single fight in any battlefield. They just left. They just withdrew. They disappeared, dispersed. They went back to their homes, their huts, their mountains, Tora Boras, and they went to Pakistan. Because they knew that they will fight another day at their choosing. And the Americans thought, we have defeated the Taliban and we have won victory. After 2 weeks, once they had done that, then if they had taken up the advice, establish peace and order, good governance, establish legitimate, bring all the parties together in Afghanistan. They said, this is your country. Here is some UN forces to help you. Thank you very much. We are going back. Our mission is complete. That's it. I think within about a couple of years, the matter would have been solved much more amicably. And that was when this Geneva Conference was held. But Geneva Conference was held in order to pick up a stooge and impose him, Muhammad Karzai, who was receiving money from Pakistani intelligence, from CIA, and from the Indian intelligence. All three intelligences.
It's because he's a liberal.
He's a liberal.
Anyway.
He still has, by the way, three houses in Pakistan. He has a big palatial house in Quetta, and then some other places. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.